This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. An in-depth investigation of privately owned nursing homes finds that cost-cutting and profits are often prioritized over patient safety and well-being. Over 70% of nursing homes in the United States are privately owned. Here in Wisconsin, 56% of certified nursing facilities were privately owned as of 2023, according to data from KFF. What does it mean for residents and staff when profit is part of the picture at a nursing home? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one live in some kind of nursing care facility? Is it for-profit or non-profit? Has it changed in recent years? Do you work in this business? Do you see a difference when for-profit companies take over nursing homes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sean Campbell is an independent investigative journalist. He co-wrote a new report in The Conversation on for-profit nursing homes. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is something I didn't know. I think maybe a lot of people may not have suspected. Why is for-profit business such a big player in nursing homes in Wisconsin and around the country?
Yeah, well, it might seem a little counterintuitive, but for-profit nursing homes and nursing home sector, by and large, is very profitable, despite what some nursing home providers may want people to believe. There's always this talk of constantly being cash trapped, but a congressional research service so found that this is at least half a trillion dollars of government money flows into this industry. And not only are there profits from the direct payments, but for-profit nursing homes can also own the pharmacy that's associated with providing medications or the staffing industry or business that provides staffing. So not only do these businesses get to profit off of the nursing home itself, but they get to provide the ancillary services as well to increase their profits.
Before we get into what this means for people who actually live at these nursing facilities, I want to talk a little more about the revenue here. As you mentioned, industries might point toward what look like not huge bottom lines, not huge profit margins. But you mentioned they might be profiting from the pharmacy. Also, a big part of this is real estate. So if I'm hearing this story, this is interesting to me, Sean. If I run one of these private equity or other corporations, I buy into the nursing home business. I then sell the land under the buildings to another entity that I also have a stake in. Then I charge a very big rent and maybe management and operating fees for that land. So it's another way to extract money from nursing homes. That's part of where the money's going?
Yes. In a number of cases, and a number of cases that we talk about in our article, with a real estate investment trust, a private company, a private equity company, oftentimes will start up another company that will buy the real estate from out underneath the nursing home and then charge that nursing home rents. So the rents can stay stable or they can increase over time. And that same company that owns the nursing home is essentially paying itself money for rent. And over time, as the rent can increase, and in some cases does increase, this can then be used as a reason to say that, well, this nursing home isn't profitable. We have to find a way to cut costs, maybe reduce staffing. That's often a thing that's raised by a number of these for-profit nursing homes, is that they can't afford a certain staffing level. But when you really parse who owns each individual company, more often than not, you will find that the costs that are really burdening the nursing home trace back to the original owners. Whether it be real estate is a big one, and pharmacy, as I mentioned before, or staffing agencies. And another aspect that makes this as kind of a second layer of profitability is if the nursing home fails, you have that real estate investment trust that has the land. So the nursing home can be going under, it's no longer salvageable. So then the real estate investment trust can then sell the land from underneath the nursing home, and the nursing home can close, generating another kind of wave of profits here.
Talking about for-profit ownership of nursing homes in the U.S., Sean Campbell wrote a big piece on this in The Conversation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Sean, a focus, of course, of your piece is what this means for patients at nursing homes. You open with an example in, this is Louisville, Kentucky, an outfit mm-hmm. called Landmark, owned by a company called Infinity Healthcare Management. This seems, I hope, is a worst case. Can you talk about what you saw there?
Yeah, so I will start this off too by saying that this was one of the worst cases, but not an outlier in terms of when you look at some of these for-profit middle tier, as we call them, nursing home chains. This isn't an anomaly. But at Louisville, the Landmark facility there that's owned by Infinity Healthcare, the facility was a mess. This is inspector saying this wasn't me. Even one of the own staff said that the condition seemed unsanitary. The residents were roaming the halls. In two instances, at least, there was sexual touching between the residents, which borders on sexual assault when we talk about people that might not be cognizant of their own surroundings. So this was a very bad case, and they were fined substantially for it. But Infinity actually owns a number of poor performing nursing homes that aren't too far off from Landmark. And since the story has published, even in Kentucky, there's facilities that outpace the level of fines of Landmark at Louisville. So again, this was a bad case where you have sexual touching, you have in one instance, an assault from a nursing and staff pushing down a resident and injuring them. But it's by far not alone.
You mentioned fines. Who is in charge of regulating these nursing homes and deciding if a company should be able to buy more of them?
Yeah, so the predominant organization that's in charge of regulating these nursing homes is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS for short. That's run through the federal government, and it's a little bit of a structured way of overseeing this. There are state inspectors, and then there are federal inspectors, and then there can also be another layer of oversight that's particular to each state that can be run by state health departments or local health departments. So there's all of this kind of comes together in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but the inspectors can come from multiple areas. And this is, again, a part because over $460 billion flows into this industry annually. So it behooves the federal government to take an ownership of regulating and looking after to these nursing homes to make sure there's some level of oversight and care being given.
And when it comes to these fines, are they seen as a sufficient deterrent or something that once a company receives them seems to turn around their behavior?
So fines are an easy way to kind of put a dollar amount to harm, to poor care. But when you actually factor in how much money they can make on a monthly or annual basis, it's not that much. But fines typically lead to what can really hurt a nursing home, which are payment denials. This is once you have these levels of repeated high fines and numerous lapses of care, CMS can cut off the payments that come from the federal government. And that can really, that basically just cuts off the flow of money into the nursing home. So the company has a vested interest in terms of fixing this. So I want to put that out there too, where mm-hmm. fines are significant and the next level up from the fines, which isn't as easy for people to kind of wrap their heads around, are payment denials where money is actually cut off from the facilities. Now, this is an incentive to get their act together, but again, like we talked about before, these can be incredibly profitable, especially when you're paying yourself money for taking care of the residents. So it's an incentive to improve your profitability. But in some cases, and with some of the more problematic owners that we found, it's not as much of an incentive to provide good care as we would hope.
We're talking to journalist Sean Campbell about a new report on for-profit nursing home companies and their records of fines and cost-cutting. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What has your experience been like with nursing homes? If you've been to one yourself or have a loved one there or you work there, have you seen positive or negative experiences? Do you think it matters if one is operated for profit or non-profit? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up a conversation about the for-profit nursing home industry. Over 70% of nursing homes in the U.S. are privately owned, over half in Wisconsin. Our guest investigation found lots of concerns, including safety and well-being of patients. Sean Campbell stays with us, investigative journalist based in New York. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ron is with us in Poinette. Ron, hi.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Ron. What did you want to bring up?
I'm curious. How do you find out if a nursing home is privately owned or what you're talking about, the corporation? Mm-hmm. I'm 80 years old. I hope I don't have to go into one. But why is this legal in the United States?
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, transparency, Sean. Is it easy to tell if a company is for-profit or non-profit? If it's for-profit, is it easy to tell who actually owns it?
So CMS does have this information. When you go to Care Compare, you can look up nursing homes from their website, and they'll give you a star rating system, and it will give you those kinds of information as to whether they're for-profit, government-owned, or non-profit. There is also, to give a little plug here for ProPublica, ProPublica has the Nursing Home Compare that has even more granular information, has all the information that CMS has, but makes it more easy to not only see what the star ratings are, but to also pull up what some of the more recent reports have been, inspection reports, so you can see how many times they've been fined. But by and large, the star rating system is fine, but it has its problems. The inspections, that's another way of judging care, but it's hard to really judge a nursing home just by the care of when an inspector goes in there and what they see. It's another metric that you can use, for-profit, private, or non-profit, another thing that you kind of use to really understand. The new piece of information, which what our investigation focused on, which was really linking the chains together, which is something that CMS started doing last year, where they have what's called affiliated entities, which you can also see with Nursing Home Compare. It'll tell you what their affiliated entity is. But looking and seeing what the affiliated entities are, I feel is probably the best bet to judge the quality of a nursing home. When we looked at these figures, and we talked about the mid-sized chains that seem to be the poor performers compared to one-off owners or people that just own a handful of nursing homes, or even the largest for-profit companies, the mid-sized groups seem to have the most issues with them. But there are good nursing home chains. There are good for-profit nursing home chains, and it shows across their facilities. And these are the facilities that will typically have higher overall quality rating, lower levels of fines, all sorts of the metrics that you want to look at. If there is quality within those chains, I think it's a good bet that that facility is also going to be of a higher quality. So it's not as easy as it should be to really differentiate the good from the bad, but there are ways to do it using some of the tools I mentioned. And at least recently, some of this transparency is improving, if not nearly as good as it could be.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go to Elizabeth now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
I'm sorry, excuse me.
That's okay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We had a pretty bad experience with my mother being in a basically a Medicare-funded nursing home. Excuse me, I'm sorry. medication mix-ups. Within a week, she had a wrist sprain issue, found out that some CNAs were not even fully certified, yet this place touted their lovely little dining room with their, you know, tablecloths and whatnot. That seemed to be more important to present to people. And it was pretty sad. And I think, you know, some people don't have a choice as to what type of nursing home they can go into. Some of the wealthier people can go into nicer places, and that issue isn't there. I know for a fact because I visited people at nicer places.
Sure, Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. Sorry for that experience. You look in your piece at research, Sean, on you know what happens when these facilities go from nonprofit to for-profit in some cases. I think JAMA, there was research published. What do we see when it comes to increased risks of health hazards like that, even emergency room visits?
Yeah. For what I want to say, I'm sorry for your experience, caller. These things can be difficult. And when we talk about when they switch from nonprofit or government to for-profit, generally we see a decline in quality. We see an even larger decline in quality when they move from into the hands of private equity companies, which private equity by and large emphasizes short-term returns on profits. So it's not kind of the long-term investment that you would hope for or want. I wouldn't even say hope for, that you would want or need when it comes to nursing home care, because these are people that have substantial health issues. That's where you see an even larger decline. And there's research that backs up that as well, that over a period of time when private equity firms get involved, we see declines in care and even outcomes, higher risk mortality, adverse events, like you mentioned, medication mix-ups. Mm-hmm. What will happen with a lot of these companies, like the caller alluded to there, is that when people come in, people often don't have a choice. Sometimes your family member is infirmed or they suddenly just started showing signs of dementia and can't care for themselves, or they don't have the money to really look after them themselves at home, which can be incredibly expensive. So a lot of attention can be given to the aesthetics of a facility, but the underlying care of staffing or the people who are being staffed, the level of management oversight, those are the areas where you can cut costs, and a layperson walking in wouldn't necessarily know the difference. Everything would just look good. It's only until something bad happens that you begin to question that. So these are all the things that we do see with research, that lower levels of staffing, private equity ownership, these can all lead to reductions in care. The movement to for-profit also shows generally a reduction in care, but as I mentioned before, there are some very good for-profit facilities. There's just there's fewer than them than there are the nonprofit or government facilities.
Thanks for that call. Sean Campbell is with us. We're talking about a piece he wrote in The Conversation about for-profit businesses in the nursing home industry. Back to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello. Mary Kay, are you there? I think we lost her. Let's try George in Wanakee. George, hi.
Hi, Rob. This is George. I'm the retired state long-term care ombudsman for Wisconsin. And I remember when I was working, we were examining the vertical integration of the long-term care system in the for-profit sector, running from group homes, assisted living, nursing homes, and then discovered that there was in terms of the for-profit sector, a relationship to the larger Hospital Corporation of America, as well as some of the hotel chains such as Marriott. And I'm wondering if your examination looked at the impact of that sort of integration.
George, thanks a lot for the call. Sean, have you seen that sort of, I know some of the companies you write about also own at least healthcare facilities.
We didn't look into the hospital, or not the hospital, the hotel ownership, but there is this kind of vertical integration that where there are, they can own healthcare facilities, where again, you could have a resident who you look after in your nursing home that you can then say, this person needs care, specialized care, and then send them to one of your facilities that you also own to receive that specialized care, and then charge however much money you want to charge for that. Well, you know, within reason, where you then get to pay yourself the money and then also record it as a loss on your nursing home. So this is the one of the ways that nursing home operators can kind of gripe about being an industry that isn't very profitable. They're not making much money, but because they can charge themselves essentially high rates for things like integrated healthcare services. So yes, we do have that. We mentioned that in the story, along with, as I mentioned before, with the real estate investment trust, where not only are you charging yourself for services, you're also charging yourself for rent.
George, thanks for that call. Sean, in just our last few moments, are there any changes in regulation maybe in the works or being called for here?
There are some things that advocates have been asking for and calling for. I will also say that with the Biden administration, we have seen a noticeable uptick in fines and enforcement, a very substantial uptick, more than anywhere else. And so things are in the works for getting some regulation there. But I would argue, and I think most people who work in this sector, at least from the patient care standpoint, would say that not enough has been done. We definitely need more transparency so we can notice the bad actors, easily suss them out, and decide where we're going to take our loved ones. And then there's more regulation that could happen in terms of how are you recording your profits? Are you paying yourself a market rate? These are some of the things, and also local prosecutors can also be more in charge of levying lawsuits against the homes that can.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Sean Campbell, a journalist. His new piece in The Conversation digs into the for-profit nursing home industry. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, Governor Tony Evers signed a new bipartisan bill aimed at bolstering flood prevention in Wisconsin. It's called the Pre-Disaster Flood Resilience Grant Program, and it invests in restoring and protecting wetlands, which make communities more flood resilient. This comes after historic flooding throughout the state last spring that led Governor Evers to declare a state of emergency. According to our next guest, the United States is in a flooding crisis, with floods occurring with greater frequency and intensity. In his new book, he says it will require creative solutions working with nature instead of against it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with flooding in your community lately? Were you affected by major floods in the past? Have you moved because of concerns about flooding? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tim Palmer is a writer, photographer, former land use planner, and river conservation advocate. He's the author of more than 30 books about the environment, most recently, Seek Higher Ground, the natural solution to our urgent flooding crisis. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, I'm thrilled to be here.
Before we dig into the book, Tim, I wonder if you could talk some about wetlands. I mentioned that newly passed law here in Wisconsin aimed at boosting them. Is that an important part of flood prevention and mitigation?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, wetlands are the sponges of the earth. You know, they soak up flood waters and delay their release into the rivers and ultimately the ocean. So protecting wetlands is super important to do. And the more that we can do, the less flood damage we will have.
In Seek Higher Ground, you give kind of your origin story of your interest in floods and rivers, because you're a survivor of a flood, the Hurricane Agnes flood of 1972. Can you tell us what you saw there that inspired you to take this on as an issue for the next 40 plus years?
Yeah. Well, I was living in a small Appalachian village at the time. but a tributary to the West Branch of the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania. And, you know, all it did was rain for 3 days, but this was the center of the Hurricane Agnes storm, which had moved up the West Coast, and then it had drifted offshore, picking up more water over the Atlantic, but suddenly turned inland again and hovered over Pennsylvania for 3 days. At the time, it was the most damaging flood in American history. I happened to be there, ground zero of the storm. The water came up and up and up. It almost flooded my house, not quite, but it was close, and I ended up helping neighbors and, you know, helping my town. And as soon as I could get out, which I couldn't do for like 3 or 4 days because bridges were out, landslides were down, the water was raging. As soon as I could get out, I went back to my job, which was working as the environmental planner for Lycoming County, Pennsylvania. And there, my task was not only to figure out how we could recover from this flood, but more importantly, how we could avoid this kind of catastrophic loss in the future. And that ultimately led me on the road that that ended up with this book, Seek Higher Ground.
One big point you make in the book, Tim, is that we often live in a state of denial over flooding. We see flooding again and again, maybe in the same place over the years, over the decades, into geological time and beyond. But our attention spans get pretty short even after the last big one comes along.
Yeah, it's kind of a one-word description of the most common response to this problem, you know, denial. Right after the floods, you know, many people are motivated to do something different, but that typically fades in a few months or years at most. Whereas this problem is here to stay, and it's getting worse. And what we've done in the past is not adequate. I mean, at best, you would say it's inadequate. At worst, much of what we have done is misdirected. We relied way too heavily on building dams in an effort to stop floods from occurring, which we've not been able to do, and building levees in an effort to keep the floods away from our homes and businesses. And unfortunately, you know, dams and levees tend to work for small and medium floods, but not the really big ones, like in the Mississippi in 1993 and many other years. 93 was the great flood of American history, and 1,000 of 1,500 levees, major levees on the Mississippi basin, failed in that flood. So those were not adequate approaches. Paying relief to people after the floods occur is not adequate. What we really need to do is try to eliminate this problem altogether. And we can do that if we stop new development on open space of floodplains that remains, and if we help people to relocate wherever they're willing to go.
I want to dig into those points in a bit, but actually you write that building lots of dams and levees gives people the confidence to build and develop and live in those floodplains, believing that they're safe and they may be from those lesser floods. In a way, building those dams and levees has made us more vulnerable to flooding.
Yeah, it's kind of a vicious cycle downward. You know, we have flood damage, so the Army Corps has built dams, and people believe they're safe below them, so they build even more. But then the dams are inadequate, so we build more dams or more levees, you know, and more people move in. And ultimately, you might have imagined that this approach could have worked in the past. But now, and this is the reason I wrote the book when I did, now because of global heating, the floods are getting worse. So that approach has not worked in the past, and it's going to work even less in the future because we face floods that are more intense, more frequent, and more widespread in the years to come.
Tim Palmer is with us. We're talking about his new book. It's called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, working toward a solution, you write, requires us in some ways to embrace what might feel like a really weird mindset, the idea that flooding is A, natural, and B, beneficial. In some ways, it's been a key part of allowing life on much of Earth. Could you talk about that mindset a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. There's a whole different side to this flooding coin. you know, what we hear about so much is destruction and mayhem and loss. But in fact, floods are a natural part of what the earth does. They are part of the hydrologic cycle, which goes back to the beginning of time. We all know it. The water evaporates over the ocean. The wind carries it over land. It rains and the water flows back to sea, sometimes in very great amounts. This has happened forever. And so all the natural systems of the earth have adapted to that. And in fact, not only do they tolerate floods, but they benefit from floods. Floods aren't only inevitable, they are beneficial in the natural world, and in our world, if we could just stay out of the way of floods. For example, fish need floods. Fish need high water because that's what shapes the river channels in beneficial ways to them, creating both riffles and deep holes that are needed for cold water that's retained there. Floods are what wash sand out to our ocean beaches and form those beaches on our seacoasts. So if you like the beach, you got to like floods. If you like fish, you got to like floods. Floods are what soak into the groundwater, replenishing it. And half of our public water supplies depend on groundwater. So if you want to get water out of that tap when you turn the faucet, you got to like floods. They're critical to the way the natural world works. And what we do can be very compatible with that if we just recognized and respected this natural system that we have.
That's not the way we've developed a lot over the years. We've built lots of housing and farmland, and the list goes on and on in floodplains, where it's right there in the name, floods sometimes happen. How do you turn that trend around?
Yeah. Well, there are good ways to do that. Let me mention just a couple numbers that support that. Mm-hmm. 90% of our floodplain land is not heavily developed. It's farmland, it's wildland, it's forest, it's open space, or lightly settled land, 90%. So if we protect that land, the problem, we will prevent the problem from getting way, way worse than it already is. And another number, 7% of the land actually is floodplain. That leaves 93% that is not flood prone. And that includes a lot of other places to build. Certainly not all of that is suitable for building, but a lot of it is. And a lot of it is way more suitable than the floodplain land, you know, where we're at risk of loss and even hazards to life. So there are opportunities to go elsewhere. There is an opportunity to protect open space that remains. We need to do that through effective local zoning to protect the open space areas. Wisconsin has actually been a leader in this. And we need to support public programs of helping people to relocate off of the floodplain wherever they are willing to go. And again, Wisconsin has been a leader in that. Years ago in the 1970s and 80s, Wisconsin started it a statewide floodplain management program. They hired a very talented young hydrologist, Larry Larson, to run the program. Larry put together a great program and ultimately became the head of a group called the Association of State Floodplain Managers. It went from just a few people in the beginning to 20 chapters and 20,000 members across the United States. And these are the people in the state and local agencies that work toward better management of our floodplains. And much of that legacy of protection goes back to history in Wisconsin.
Tim Palmer is with us, writer, photographer, river conservation advocate. His new book is called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived through a flood in your community? Did you relocate to higher ground in maybe Soldiers Grove, or some people moved and some government buildings moved in Gays Mills? Were you there for the Lake Delton dam burst or the 2018 floods across northern Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Tim Palmer about his new book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a flood-prone area? Have you considered moving because of it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Jay is with us in Washburn. Jay, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. And Tim, I really appreciate the subject and the discussion. I guess I'll say as a fishery biologist who has studied riverine habitat for decades, I really appreciate your discussion on the fact that floods are essential for habitat. A lot of people think that floods are this extreme, really negative event, but they actually do a lot of good that people might not see. And then one thing I wanted to bring up, and I don't know if you cover this in your book or not, but the idea of flood frequency is something that I think people don't have a real strong understanding of. And up here in Washburn, we've had, I think, at least a couple of 500-year events in the last decade. And when people hear something about a 100-year flood, they think, well, you know, we're not going to have another one of these for 100 years. But then we have one 5 years later, and they think that the forecasts are wrong and that the forecasters don't know what they're talking about. But in fact, what's going on is there's a 1 in 100 chance of having that event in any given year. It's not a 100-year flood. It's a 1 in 100 chance, and I think people really need to understand that better.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, that's a big concern, I think, for us in the media, Tim, is how we interpret phrases like the 1,000-year flood, 500-year flood, and so on.
Yeah, may I comment on that, Rob?
Definitely, please do.
Yeah, Jay, you nailed it. I mean, it is a 100-year flood is a 1% chance of flooding in any given year. Could happen this year, could happen next year. However, in the really long term, we should not be seeing 100-year floods happening, you know, 2 and 3 years in a row, or even once or twice every two decades. And so much of the mapping that has been done has not taken into account enough data. And when you think about it, a lot of these floodplain maps have been based on 50 years of data, or 100 is a whole lot, whereas the cycles of nature are much, much longer than that. And so we have not a whole lot of data to begin with. And now the flood frequency and intensity is increasing with global warming. And so the flood maps that were done, say, up until this point in time, really are no longer as accurate as they need to be because the floods are getting worse. And so these and other reasons mean that we need to have better floodplain mapping that more effectively relates to the kind of schedule flooding that we can expect in the future.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. We heard from Ed in Northern Illinois who wanted to hear about the Great Flood of 1927, which he says killed thousands, affected millions of acres, and should scare the heck out of people. This is something you do talk about in the book, Tim. Remind us about the flood of 1927.
Yeah. This was especially severe on the lower Mississippi, you know, in the South. And it was the biggest flood up to that time. The 93 flood has eclipsed that since then, you know, not that long ago. But one of the really significant things about 1927 was up until then, Americans pretty much across the board regarded flooding as a local issue. You know, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania flooded 18 times up till then. And yet the city was unable to get federal engagement in helping them deal with flood control. Now, you know, for better or worse, this idea of local responsibility was broadened by the 27 flood, where even Southern politicians who typically had a very anti-federal attitude and to this day do not want the federal government involved in almost anything they do except where federal benefits might be involved, even Southern politicians supported the national government becoming engaged in flood issues. And that led directly to the Flood Control Act of 1936, which also hammered the Upper Ohio Basin. So we then had this coalition of Northern and Southern interests to move Congress to act. And that law started the Army Corps of Engineers on building flood control dams. The approach still was not the right approach. You know, now Now we're launching a massive federal program to build dams wherever they would possibly could be built. The Army Corps built 400 of these. We spent billions of dollars. The flood damage continued to get worse and worse and worse because we did not match that construction effort with the ideas I talk about in my book, which are protecting open space so the floods don't get, flood damage doesn't get worse, and helping people relocate to just get away from the problem and be done with it.
Tim Palmer is with us. We're talking about his new book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. People might hear that idea of relocating and think, I don't want to leave my town, my house to move somewhere else. How do you overcome opposition to this idea of relocation as a flood solution?
Yeah, well, first of all, Rob, I don't know of any floodplain management programs today that require people to move. They are all, to my knowledge, oriented toward helping people move when they want to go. And it turns out a lot of people want to go. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, every year gets far more requests for funding assistance to help people who want to move off of the floodplain into safer terrain than they are able to pay for. So no one's making people move. A lot of people do want to move. And typically, you know, after you're flooded two or three or four, or let's say five or 10 times, people want to go. You know, they recognize that this is futile. They keep rebuilding and they keep, you know, encountering these problems over and over. Here are two amazing numbers. Let me just, yeah, my book is full of data, but let me just mention two numbers here. The Natural Resources Defense Council cranked thousands of data points on this, on the issue of federal spending for flooding. And they found that for every $1.70 that the federal government spends helping people move and get away from the flood problem, we, the federal taxpayers, spend $100 helping people to stay and endure the next flood. And we do that through funding assistance to quote, flood-proof their houses, even though there really isn't any such thing. We pay enormous subsidies for federally backed flood insurance, a program that now has a $24 billion deficit, and other programs of federal assistance that go in an extremely lopsided manner toward helping people stay and be flooded again rather than to move and solve the problem. So that ratio of federal spending, in my way of thinking, needs to be reversed so that we give more attention to helping people get away from the problem and not have it anymore.
And just our last less than a minute now, Tim, you also share a vision for what land on floodplains could look like, greenways that we still can use and appreciate.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, greenways are one of the most popular public initiatives nationwide. Everybody loves parks along rivers with trail systems and with access for boating and fishing and swimming and hiking or just sitting and watching the river flow if you want to do that. And when we reclaim these areas that have been developed on floodplains and convert them into municipal parks, that's what people get. And these programs are extremely popular. You know, I visited a number of them in the book, like in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee, and Wycoming County, Pennsylvania. And, you know, when we can make this transition to protecting open space that remains and converting developed areas, usually lightly developed areas, into parkland, we end up creating these wonderful community assets that everybody loves.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thanks again for joining us today.
Great to be with you. I hope you people enjoy the book.
That's Tim Palmer, writer, photographer, former land use planner, and river conservation advocate. He's written more than 30 books on environmental issues. He's with us for a look at his latest book. It's called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. If you have a story about how you or your community reacted after a flood, did you see improvements made, people moving away from those most flood-prone areas, for example, let us know about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A group of editors, literary scholars, critics, and writers got together to make a list of some of the most influential and important American fiction books from the past century. The result is the Great American Novels List, published by The Atlantic a couple few weeks back. It's an expansive list of 136 novels from a wide range of authors and genres, starting in 1925 and ending in 2023. One of the project editors joins us now for a behind-the-scenes look at what went into making this list and to offer some reading recommendations inspired by the project. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What novels from the past century would you put on your list if you made something like this? Did you read any novels in high school or college that have stuck with you? What made them so special? Have you read any new fiction books lately that you think will stand the test of time, American or otherwise? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Ellen Cushing is a senior editor at The Atlantic, one of the lead editors of the Great American Novels Project. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Great could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. What was great in the context of coming up with this list of 136 novels?
I love this question. I've been getting it a lot.
I bet.
And I should say, like, look, this is, of course, subjective.
Sure.
You could have 100 geniuses make their own version of this list and you get 100 different lists. But for us, what we were looking for was, you know, force of ideas, like novels that had something to say about the world in some way. Beautiful prose, that is obviously very important. Unforgettable characters. And we were also really looking for books that did something new or surfaced a new way of thinking about things, like that were sort of significant in addition to being great reads. So if a book hit all four of those boxes, it was very likely to get on our list.
And somebody might hear this concept and think this is all going to be highfalutin literary fiction. And I think there's some of that here, but there are genres, there's science fiction, there's a Stephen King horror. You were casting a wider net than, say, maybe an academic list of great novels might be.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, one of the reasons that this project was so fun is that, like, our understanding of literary greatness is so much more capacious than it used to be. Even when I was in high school 20 years ago, there was a pretty set list of books that were considered the canon. And now we understand greatness to take a lot of different forms. So we have a couple graphic novels, we have some children's books, we have a lot of sci-fi, we have a lot of noir mystery type books. You know, these are not exclusively like giant doorstop novels about war and peace written by like white guys. You know, it's a much, and we have some of those, don't
sure.
worry. But it's a really diverse list in across all different vectors.
I think weirdly, one of the things I like the most is that you came up with 136. You know, a lot of times we go top 100 or a nice round number. You assembled the collection, it sounds like, and then found what number you were at, which I love.
Yes. It drives me crazy when I read a list that's like 100 or 500 or, God forbid, 1,000, because I'm just desperate to know what the 101st was. And so we just decided, like, look, no one's making us stick to a certain number. Let's just come up with the books that we think should be on this list, and that's the list. So it turned out it was 136.
Talking to Ellen Cushing from The Atlantic about the Great American Novels Project. You could join in at 800-642-1234. American novels from last 100 years. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. Let's start naming names, Ellen. The oldest on the list, not a huge surprise, I guess, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Can you talk about kicking off this time span with a pretty big name there?
You know, it's a classic for a reason. It's a really, really good book. And, you know, there were a lot of books like this, you know, I would consider also like The Grapes of Wrath, you know, books that a lot of people read in high school or college. And it was really important to us to not just assume that those books deserve to be on the list because we've all been talking about them for so long. So we actually revisited these books. I read the first, I don't know, 60 pages of The Great Gatsby to refresh my memory. And it's a great book with so much to say. So I'm really proud that we have that on the list first. From the same year, we also have An American Tragedy, which is a book that I had not heard of before we put it on the list. And then we have this, you know, like surrealist sort of like very dense, I think it's like 1,000-page Gertrude Stein novel. So it's already like even as far back as 1925. We have a lot of different kinds of books.
And you mentioned The Grapes of Wrath. You wrote the blurb for that one. Steinbeck, John Steinbeck, wrote a couple few novels himself. Why The Grapes of Wrath on the list in particular?
We were really stuck between The Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden. Because they're honestly both really, really, really great American novels. But we decided to go for The Grapes of Wrath mostly because it really innovated in its moment. You know, this was a time when a lot of Steinbeck's contemporaries, like other novelists, were really interested in kind of like glamorous, coastal, beautiful people and their problems. And Steinbeck was interested in writing books about real people in, you know, experiencing the sort of like biggest struggles of his moment. And that was, you know, the climate crisis of the Dust Bowl and westward migration. And he was really interested in human suffering. And that's pretty, it was radical in its moment. And we wanted to recognize that significance.
Now, Ellen, maybe you can help me with some personal advice here. I like to read a lot. I've read some of the books on the list. I haven't read a lot of the books. Somewhere in my reading career, I got allergic to the word should. Like in my head, like, I haven't read that great book. I should read it. And once I start thinking that way, it's like, oh, so now it's a chore. I'm never going to read it. How do I break out of that and read these great books without that? I don't know. Maybe this is just me. I don't know. How do I get out of that should mindset?
I mean, I think that like no one should be in the should mindset. I hear that from people all the time, people that I work with, people that I've met talking about this. You know, so many times over the last couple of weeks talking about this project, I hear people say, and they sort of have this kind of like guilty expression on their face, like, oh, I really should read that, you know? And my answer is like, no, you shouldn't. Only read it if you want to. Like, this is supposed to be for pleasure. Like, we're not in school anymore. No one's making us read these books. You should read this book if it grabs onto you and if you love it. My friend's mom is in a book club where their rule is that you take your age and you subtract it from 100. And that is the number of pages you need to read of a novel before you are allowed to give up on it. I love that because it's true that we shouldn't, no one should be wasting their time on something that doesn't bring them joy. Like reading is for pleasure. And the older you get, like the more important it is to just abandon the should. So I guess I didn't really answer your question. I'm not helping you.
Oh no, that actually helped a lot.
I'm giving you permission to don't read a book if you don't love it.
Excellent. I love it. Now let's move in another direction. Now there's a Stephen King book on the list, and I could see some great American fiction list saying Stephen King, you know, that's popular literature or whatever, not going to touch it. There he is. The Stand is on the list. Can you talk about the inclusion of your Stephen Kings of the world?
I'm so glad you mentioned The Stand because I had not read it before this project. I've not read all 136 books. I'm coming clean now. I had not read it before this project, but I just started it. And I love it. It is so, so much more interesting, so much more layered than my perception of it. I thought it was Stephen King. It's the Carrie guy. It's going to be scary. It's going to be sort of obvious. It's so rich. It's so layered. It's so complex. It is absolutely a great American novel. Like it absolutely stands up against all of these other books. And, you know, I think one of the great things about genre is that if you sort of take the reader out of the world that they live in. You know, we have some books that do not take place on planet Earth because they're sci-fi, or take place in a kind of post-apocalyptic speculative version of Earth. And doing that really puts the reality of life on Earth or in America into sharp relief. Like, I think it's a really genius way to kind of examine this country and its problems and what it's like to be alive from a little bit of a distance. So I think these books absolutely belong on here.
Ellen Cushing is with us, senior editor at The Atlantic. We're talking about The Atlantic's new Great American Novels list. It includes 136 novels published over the last century, including familiar classics, recent favorites, overlooked gems along the way. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you got to pick a couple few slots on the list, what would you put there? Let us know about it. Have we been talking about some of your favorites so far? Is there one that you think gets overlooked, maybe unfairly, for one reason or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ellen Cushing from The Atlantic about what went into making their new Great American Novels list and a great list of suggestions for books we can check out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I know we've got at least a few readers out there. How do you decide which new or classic book to read next? Do you look at the literary prizes, best of lists, or do you have favorite people in your life that you like to get recommendations from? What would you put on your list of great American novels and why? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Can you talk about some of the diversity on this list? There's a wide variety of perspectives on what it means to experience life in America. Ellen, how did you try to capture that?
You know, we did not go into this project wanting to hit a certain quota, but you'll see as you go through the list of books chronologically, it starts out with a lot of, you know, like white men in their 30s and 40s, and then white American born men in their 30s and 40s. And then it kind of expands in a lot of different ways. So, you know, later on in the list, we have the book, A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, who's born in Jamaica. Like, we have a lot of people who are sort of similar to this idea that like sci-fi or genre helps us see our world in a clearer way. I think that having, you know, immigrant writers who are writing about America with the, you know, fresh perspective of someone who did not grow up here, that's so important. And I think these books, some of those books are so insightful and, you know, like it's just so important to see that stuff. And, you know, we looked at diversity in all kinds of different ways. Like we have books that are really short and really long, and we have books that's absolutely huge, just the sort of idea of what a great American novel should look like. And then we have Watchmen, which is, a graphic novel written by a pair of British men who were writing about a sort of alternative version of the U.S. after the Cold War, you know? So like, if you told your grandfather that was going to be on a list of the great American novels, he'd probably be shocked. But as soon as we started talking about it, it just felt right.
Now, you were part of this process. A lot of people were. Was there a book or two that you really went to bat for or would have if people hadn't put it on the list? What did you really want to see end up there?
So the book that I wish I'd fought harder for, don't laugh, is Gone Girl. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I mentioned it sort of as a joke, and we didn't really revisit it. And the more I thought about it, the more I have thought about it since the list came out. Gone Girl was the first example of a kind of book that has been imitated so much that it's almost hard to see its impact. Like the narrative structure, the big twist, the voice of the narrators, all of these things are things that you see in so many of like the most interesting and most popular books now. But Gone Girl did it first, and then like it did it so well that it was imitated so much so fast that we all kind of forgot that Gillian Flynn did it first. So, and you know, that's a book, speaking of diversity, that like people I think kind of think of as a sort of genre book or maybe kind of an airport book. It, you know, it was made into a movie, and I don't know that people think of it as a great American novel, but I think it kind of is. I think it has a lot going on.
I haven't read it. I read a short story by the author that blew me away for some of the reasons you just said. So that I will put that on my should
it's
fun
great.
In the fun way list. Awesome.
Oh, you'll have so much fun with it.
Excellent.
It's great.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Jenny is with us in West Allis. Jenny, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi. This is amazing. I just wanted to say that what brought me to reading and back to it maybe is going back to like that first book that just said, yeah, you know what? This is super cool. And my book was, oh my gosh, I just lost it.
I think you told our producer it was Harriet the Spy. Yeah. I hope they weren't lying to me.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that. It was, Oh my gosh. I feel like an idiot right now. No, it was, Harriet the Spy and then Charlotte's Web.
Ah, okay. There we got it. Jenny, thanks. I'm glad you thought of it. And Charlotte's Web is one of the three children's books on the list, Ellen.
Yes. Charlotte's Web is very special to us at The Atlantic because E.B. White wrote an essay about a pig that kind of sat in his brain for a little while. And he wrote this essay for The Atlantic, and then he wrote kind of a fiction version that turned out to be Charlotte's Web. So we love E.B. White at The Atlantic. We love Charlotte's Web. I'm so proud that we have it on there. I think it's a very, very rich, layered book that gets at a lot of really big themes, even though it's sort of packaged as a children's book. And Harriet the Spy is an amazing book. I used to, I really wanted to be her for many, many years of my life. We talked about it for this project, and I don't remember exactly why we didn't keep it on, but it's a great pick. It is absolutely one of those books that made me fall in love with reading when I was a little kid.
And thanks again for that call, Jenny. Another one for younger readers, Judy Blume. I mean, in my generation, Judy Blume was huge. You've got Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I can see why that one ended up on the list. Talk about that a little bit.
It's a really special book for a lot of reasons. It is one of these. It came out in 1970, and it is still a book that you want your kids to read. You know, my son is 18 months right now, so like his favorite novel is Where Is the Dog? But I hope that eventually, when, you know, in 15 years, I can give him Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and it will unlock something inside of him. Like, this is a book about belonging and about family and about growing up and about who you are, and it's about religious faith, and it's about what adulthood really means, and it's about living in a body. There's so much to it, and I'm really proud that we have it on there.
Talking to Ellen Cushing, senior editor at The Atlantic, talking about their Great American Novels Project, 136 books from over the last 100 years. Ellen, what are you hoping people do with this list now? What are you hoping people take away from it?
I'm hoping that people never feel like they don't know what to read again. I think that what I wanted was for people to bookmark this list and return to it whenever they're kind of standing paralyzed in the bookstore and don't know what to get. I know I will be returning to it. I've heard from a lot of people who are trying to read every book on the list. As you have heard, I don't want anyone to feel like this is a homework assignment, but if you want to take that on, that's amazing. Please email me when you finish. I'll buy you a beer or something. I hope that people, look at this list, think about it, think about what greatness means, and find a really great read.
Now, when you put out a list like this, sometimes people take it as fighting words. Are you getting a lot of hopefully good-natured questions like, where is so-and-so an author? Or why'd you pick that book instead of that book by a particular author?
We sure are. And, you know, that's been a joy because it's so nice to hear from other readers and to hear from people who have really, really strong feelings about the books they love. So, you know, I think that people sometimes have felt a little bit sheepish complaining, and that's great. Like, this is subjective. I was never under the impression that like we were right and everybody else is wrong. And if you want to come up to me and talk to me about, you know, this is a big one, is Pynchon Gravity's Rainbow versus Crying of Lot 49. We thought it through. We put Crying on the list. I'm feel very confident in that decision. But if a Gravity's Rainbow super fan wants to talk to me about Gravity's Rainbow and why they love it, like, that's a great conversation for me to have.
And Ellen, you mentioned based on this, you're reading The Stand. You're just a little bit into it. Anything else that came up in this project that instantly shot to the top of your haven't read but want to read list?
Oh, there are so many. I can't decide what I'm going to read after I read The Stand. Just a few that come to mind. There was this book called Family Life by Akhil Sharma from a few years ago that my colleague Gal Beckerman wrote about. It's a book about a pair of brothers, and it seems like it's a book about kind of how you sort of break and then repair a family. It sounds really, really great. There are a couple of books that I haven't read since high school that I would like to reread. So Giovanni's Room, I read, you know, almost 20 years at this point, and I am really, really excited to jump back into it. I feel very, very lucky to have been so close to this, and I'm genuinely overwhelmed about what I'm going to read after The Stand. The Stand is like 1300 pages.
Right. You're
so
set for a while.
Yeah.
Ellen, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ellen Cushing, senior editor at The Atlantic. We've been talking about The Atlantic's newly published list of great American novels. Some classics there, surprises, lots of options to add to your stack of books to read. Keep sharing your favorites. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on Central Time, private equity and other companies are getting into the nursing home and senior care business. We'll ask the question, what does it mean when senior facilities are run as for-profit enterprises? That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.